Hey everyone, happy Friday. In this Lisa at the Edge episode, I am joined by Barbara Forbes. Barbara is an IT consultant at SCCT in the Netherlands and also a Microsoft MVP. Barbara gave a talk at Ignite before she was an MVP about how to automate as a team. The talk was so popular that they added another session. However, the talk was only 20 minutes long, so Barbara has joined me to share more on this interesting topic. We also discover another How I Got Into IT story. Hope you enjoy listening.
Hey, Barbara. Hey, Barbara. Thank you so much for joining the Lisa at the Edge podcast.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we've got you on today to talk a little bit about, of course, I'm developing a bit of a theme, so hearing how you got into tech would be awesome. But the main focus of our chat today is going to be around automating as a team. So yeah. You delivered a talk at last year's Ignite, I believe, on automating as a team. It was super popular. You had to do it twice, but it was only 20 minutes long, and it sounds like a really interesting topic. So I'd like to get into it in a bit more depth on this podcast, if that's okay.
Yeah, great.
Awesome. So do you want to start off by just giving us a quick introduction as to who you are and what you do?
Yes, my name is Barbara Forbes and I'm an IT consultant working for SCCT in the Netherlands. And I work with Azure mostly, Azure, Microsoft 365 server management, but my passion is automation. So Azure and automations work a lot with PowerShell, Azure DevOps, infrastructure as code, stuff like that. And I write a blog about these things, which is called forbes.nl. And yeah, since last March, I believe I am a Microsoft MVP. So that's pretty awesome. Cool for that. So I like going around speaking.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
It's definitely not it. There's definitely
there's more to it, but that's a nutshell. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. Okay, so let's just spend a little bit of time talking about how you got into tech, because when we first had our sort of prep discussion, I found that again, here is someone who does not have a traditional, you know, that you think tech background, but is, you know, here in tech, loving life, being a Microsoft MVP. So would you mind sharing just a little bit about that with us?
Yeah, I got from pretty far from tech, actually, because I studied to be an art therapist. So I have a Bachelor of Art Therapy.
Wow.
Which means that you would use it as therapy for people with disabilities or people with mental problems or children often. And instead of talking to these people about their problems, you use art to help them around, like drawing or painting or stuff like that.
Yeah.
So art. That's pretty far from tech. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh my God, what's just happened? Oh God! Oh, so my laptop's just started doing crazy stuff. No.
Yeah.
Two podcasts in a row that I've had my first bloopers, and I can't. Needs to stop. Okay, sorry. So yes, art therapy definitely. Potentially the furthest. I'm not sure. Maybe the furthest away from tech that I've the story that I've had so far. So how did you then go from having a master's in art therapy to finding your way to a career in tech?
Yeah, bachelor, I should say. But
bachelor, sorry.
I actually first started working in the field. Well, more or less in the field, because there is a problem with art therapy, and that's that there are not that many jobs as an art therapist. So I first started working in childcare for after-school care with children. And after that, I started working as a social worker for children who weren't able to live at home.
Okay.
So I did it actually for a few years. That was really my first working experience.
Okay.
Well, in the professional field. And well, this was 2013, somewhere around that. You know, the economy was pretty bad. Mm-hmm. And social care, that was the first place where you saw issues with, I just couldn't keep track of a job because they would say, well, we really love you here, but yeah, we are not allowed to keep you any longer.
My friend is a social worker, and that area is always the first to receive cuts, and it's really unfair because it's such an important service. And it's the same with, like you were saying, about art therapy. You know, there's not a lot of jobs there, and that's because there's, you know, not enough attention paid or resources and funding put into therapy as general, in general, never mind, you know, different forms of therapy. So yeah, that's a story that I've heard also from my friend.
Yeah, it was actually a bit of a struggle when I started in IT, because I used to work with children who were removed from a home that worked very well because the placements was too expensive.
Yeah.
And then I got to an IT company that was doing very well, or a company that I did IT for. And everyone was nagging because they wanted to have a bigger screen and stuff like that. I thought it was so... That did take a bit of adjusting.
Yeah, a bit of getting used to, a bit of, yeah, sort of change, having been somewhere where the perspectives are just so different.
Yeah.
We call that first world problems.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, the bad thing to say is I'm kind of used to it now.
Yeah. Yes, I don't think any, I mean, you know, I was just tweeting earlier today about how I'd really like to upgrade my mic equipment because I've been listening back to some of the podcasts, and I can tell the difference between myself and my little jabber conference speaker, and obviously people who have got better mics, etc. But it, you know, in comparison to what's going on in the world right now, it's really not that big a deal, and I'm sure I'll be
we will fine. Survive. Yeah.
Exactly. So your first role within IT, what was that role?
The first role, actually, well, what I did is I started working for an IT company that worked a lot with people who did not have the right education.
Okay.
And maybe even not the right experience, but who did have the will to grow themselves and to become better and learn on the job. And that was exactly what I was looking for.
Yeah.
And I got in there. I remember they asked me, do you think you're going to like this job? Uh-huh. And I said, I think so, but I never even worked at an office.
Okay, so yeah.
I said, I have no idea, but I would love to find out. Mm-hmm. And the first job I got was administration for an IT service desk. So that was asset management, mostly putting really boring forms into a computer because that wasn't automated for some reason.
Yeah.
And it was a very good job to get started, but that really wasn't a lot of work, all that administration. And of course, it wasn't what I wanted to do. So I was right there in the service desk. And every time I saw someone working with a computer, working on a program, I said, can I watch what you're doing?
Yeah.
Can I see what doing? And that started my journey up there. I learned incredibly lot with a lot there with just the colleagues that were there and who were very eager to teach me. And I guess that was the beginning of the IT career there.
Yeah, that's really lucky that you found a business like that who is willing to put the time and investment into people who necessarily didn't come from the, like you say, had the right education or background, or and they were just willing to sort of grow you as an IT professional. That's a really nice story to hear, actually.
Yeah, and they did it a lot with people who actually studied in fields where it wasn't easy to get jobs.
Okay.
And we actually had at some point we had so many people who studied biology.
Right.
Which is also, but there are almost no jobs in biology.
Yeah.
Unless you want to teach at a high school or something like that. Well, then you go work in IT.
Work in IT. Weird. I get now. My mission is to find someone who is a biologist to come on the show and talk to me about how they came from biology to IT. You think that would be awesome? So, how long did you stay at that company before you then moved on?
Well, sorry, I was in that because I had the IT company, and they would send me to a different company where I would do that service desk job. Sorry. And I stayed there for a few months, and at that point I found out there that I wasn't able to grow anymore, because I said I do not want to do any administration anymore. I want to full on do the service desk. And they didn't want that. So the company I worked for actually said, well, that's fine. Come back. We're going to find something new for you. Uh-huh. And from then I did some courses, mm-hmm. some really long courses. They really taught me a lot, and I worked my way up to system administration. And in the end, I was doing the internal IT for the IT company.
Nice.
I did it for a year and a half, something like that.
Nice.
Yeah, that was really one of the funnest places in that company, I believe.
Yeah.
I mean, we're a Microsoft partner, so we had a lot of new technology, and it's fun to do IT for people who work in IT.
Yeah, yeah. that's a nice different, that's a different perspective. And when we were speaking on our prep call, you said that it was through this journey that you finally felt like you belonged, like you'd found where you wanted to be. And that is another theme that I hear quite frequently from people who maybe didn't come into IT through the traditional routes, is that once they found IT, they were like, this is where I'm meant to be. Like, I really like this.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sounds a bit dramatic to say it like that, but I always felt like computers were a hobby and doing things with computers. And I was building websites and stuff like that. And I never envisioned it to be my daily job. Mm-hmm. It just never came to my mind. And all the time that I was working with children, I felt like I was adequate at the work. I never felt I was really good for it in it.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if that's true or if it's just more a feeling of me, because I felt well, and what I really missed before was the ability to grow.
Yes. Okay.
I'm crazy ambitious. I wanted to do more and get further, and I always missed that. And when I started working with computers, I not only understood all those computers, but I appeared to be good at it.
Yeah. And there's...
And I understood the people. Yeah. I understood the people they were working with me. I thought, these people are just like me.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. And you're so right. I suppose working in any public service, you are limited by rules and regulations and budgets, etc. You don't really have a lot of autonomy over what you can do, so you probably always felt like you couldn't sort of burst out of those barriers. Whereas when you got into IT, I think you quickly learned that there's a vast amount of things that you can do, there's a whole load of stuff that you can learn, and the opportunity for growth is just huge. And one thing that I found really interesting when we first spoke is that, you know, when you were first asked the question, where do you want to be in 5 years, which is a question I personally really struggle with, you were, like you say, ambitious, and you were clear, and you said you want to be the best.
Yeah, because I hate the question as well, because I don't want to know where I want to be in 5 years. But at that point, when I saw that question, I thought, I know what I want to be. I'm going to be the best IT person in the Netherlands. And I used IT person because I had no clue where I could grow to. System administrator and network admin. I didn't know what all these functions were.
Yeah.
And all these roles that were available. I had no clue where I wanted to go. I just knew I'm going to be the best.
Yeah.
And actually, as I started growing with the company, they asked that question in the semi-annual meetings. Mm-hmm. And they would ask the question, where do you see yourself in 2 years? And it had to be more concrete than the, I'm going to be the best.
Yeah.
And I always answered, I've come further than I would have imagined. So if I'm going to set a goal for 2 years, I'm going to take myself back. I'm going to keep myself back.
Yeah.
Because everything has been going so fast and so great.
Yeah. Yeah. You kind of just want to stay on that track. And get better. That's awesome. I love that. I love that story, and I really do love that approach. And I think that it's really common that you see the people who do really, really well in IT, a lot of the MVPs that I speak to, they all have this common drive, ambition. They want to constantly learn. They're not afraid of not knowing everything because they realize how vast the topic is, and they want to help others and all this kind of stuff. So I think that's a really awesome story to hear. Thank you so much for sharing that with me.
One thing I do want to mention where I find myself so lucky is that I love what I do. Because I have seen people in the field in those years, people who were also starting in IT, who were also like, I want to grow and I want to be big, but they didn't love IT.
Yeah.
They didn't love what they do. And it's so much harder to do it then. And you can feel it with people. If they don't love it, you can feel it some way. It's so much harder to grow that way. So I guess I was lucky in that I still think I have the greatest job in the world.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think, you're right. You can tell when people don't love it. And that's not good for the individual or the company or the people that they're serving. But I think there is, if people really begin to feel stuck. I think when people feel like they've spent a number of years in a certain field or they've invested a certain amount of time into certifications or down a certain path, they feel like they have to continue down that path. They feel like, you know, it's a sunk investment if they then walk away from it. But all they're doing is building up that sunk investment and ultimately not making themselves happy. And I think what's really nice about your story and some of the others that have been shared on the podcast is that I really hope that they, not that they persuade people to leave IT, but they give people a different perspective on the fact that even if you've gone down a certain road, if your gut is pulling you in a different direction, or if, like you say, you're not loving what you do, then it's okay to change. It's never too late, and there's never too much investment that could have been made to keep you attached to doing something that you don't really like.
Yeah, well, all those stories that you had before where people moved on to IT from a completely different field, well, they show that's the concept of a second chance.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
And there is always a second chance, or a third, or a fourth.
Yep, absolutely. And also, I think that people who come into IT from different backgrounds, or people who come from IT and move into different industries, I think that that's a great thing. You know, you can then share different ways of thinking, different ways of working, different perspectives. And I think ultimately, for an individual or a company that you work for, that's a great thing.
Yeah, the different perspectives.
Yeah,
that's absolutely where you get different people with different experiences, and it can help so much.
Yeah, can help think differently. Okay, So on to the main topic, automating as a team. So I listened to your talk on this, and I really loved some of the ideas that you had around how do you automate as a team, how do you make it a team effort. The fact that you focus so much on mindset and culture as opposed to tooling, although I know we're going to get into that in a bit more depth as well, but you really focus on the culture and the mindsets within the team as being the sort of foundation for successfully automating as a team. So I wondered if you could just take us through some of those concepts.
Yeah, because I'm going to switch some things up in the order from the talk, because otherwise people can just listen to the talk.
Yes, that's right.
I want to start with the reason why I thought of this subject. The reason is that I've seen a lot of the same patterns through all those different environments as I work myself up in that IT company. And now I also see it in other companies. I saw a lot of the same patterns with how people are working. And how people are working by themselves or with each other. Mm-hmm. And the final draw for me to start this talk was, I did happen at one point that I had that experience of a company going down by an error in a script.
Okay.
And I'm not going to talk about the technical stuff or too much details to respect the privacy of that company. But it's so intense when you see your company go down and you're responsible to fix it. And that was a point where we got together as a team, actually. And I really started thinking about these concepts, thinking, where did this happen? What went wrong? And how can we fix it? And this is not just us. This happens all the time. If it happens to bigger companies, you actually get the news. You can hit the news with it. And what if that's your little script that made that little little error, which brings down an entire company? And as I was developing that talk, I saw a movie. And I saw the movie Free Solo. And Free Solo is a movie about a guy that does rock climbing. And the concept of free solo climbing is that you have to do it on your own. And you cannot use any protection. You can use no protection, no ropes, no harnesses. The concept is that you rely on your own strength and skill. And apparently it only counts if you go high enough that if you fall down, it will be fatal.
Wow.
And it was a pretty intense movie. And it was kind of hard to understand for me because this guy was climbing up on a mountain and practicing for that while he got news about his friends who had made a small error and fallen to his death.
Wow.
And that didn't stop him from going.
Mm.
And I thought it is a bit of a long stretch to compare that with us sitting safely behind our desk and putting stuff into our keyboard and in the computer. But it does represent the way I see a lot of people working.
Okay.
I see a lot of people that are writing their code. They're doing it completely alone. There are no harnesses. There is no ropes. There is not talking with your colleagues. And at some point, when you're using code, you're going to climb high enough that a fall might be fatal and that company is going to go down.
Yeah.
And I see it happen too much to think, well, someone is being silly, which you would think with Free Solo. You think, well, that's a special guy. I hope he enjoys himself. But we do it a lot in IT.
Yeah, happens too much to just be down to an individual's way of thinking.
Yeah. Like this seemed to be almost a group way of thinking.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking about what I have seen around me in when I was working with other people, but also with feelings that I've experienced myself, which caused us to start working on our own and to take all those safety harnesses away. And the first thing that I think is pretty big in that, in which I experienced myself, is that you want to prove yourself.
Yeah.
And especially if you've coming from another function, if you come from the service desk and suddenly you're a junior system administrator and you want to prove that you're worthy and that you know what you're doing. And I felt that myself. I became a junior system administrator, and all these servers really scared me, but I was like, no, they thought I belonged here and I need to show what I can do.
Yeah.
And one of the hardest things at that point is to say, I don't know. Or even, I'm not sure. It can be so hard to admit. Well, I think a lot of people can say half of us have no clue what we're doing half of the day.
Yes, definitely.
But it can be so hard to admit that little point. I'm not sure what I'm doing here. So you keep your fingers crossed and you start working and you hope you don't fall.
Start climbing. You start climbing without the rope. And you
start climbing. There is no spotter whatsoever. You just hope you don't get too tired and you hope you don't fall. And the funny thing with that is that it gets more dangerous when someone actually is a senior.
Mm.
And they have a reputation to hold up because they can cause more damage. They're far higher up that mountain. And there was an example that I used for the talk also with people who start using infrastructure as code.
Mm-hmm.
Infrastructure as code can be dangerous. It's an awesome tool. I love to work with infrastructure as code, like Terraform or ARM templates. But if you do it wrong, it can go wrong pretty badly. And that happens if you run an ARM template, and we had that happen. Someone ran an ARM template and came to us and said, if some resources were already in that resource group and they were not in my template, Where do they go?
Oh dear.
Yeah, but the funny thing with that he had a long day, mm-hmm. because it's completely deleted and there's no way to get it back.
Yeah.
But also, he didn't think to ask us before he ran them. Or ask anyone who is a bit more experienced with just those templates, because that's really hard to do. And well, after that, you get a longer day and everyone already knows that you actually push through. You might as well have asked it before.
Yeah.
So I see that one really a lot all around me, people who are afraid to say, I'm not sure what I'm doing. And another thing that I see is a lack of educating people and also a lack of time. Those two are pretty close together. Because I see a lot of plans to make changes, but I rarely see a plan that says educate the team.
Mm-hmm. Or a plan that says, here is some scheduled time to take care of those changes or take care of that technical debt or educate and upskill.
Yeah, learn.
There's never time built in for that. It's so rare.
And the technology is moving so fast. You really need the time to keep up with what is going on. And you really can't rely on what we did last time.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, if you don't educate, your knowledge gets lost. You know all this stuff, and in the end, you move to a different team, and your old team doesn't know anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really an investment to have your whole team be prepared to work on something. And that's actually, I think, if you look at traditional IT, that's one of the dangers of automation.
Yes.
Is that people do not get to click around anymore, from which they can learn so much. So I'm not sure how to solve that one, but I think, for example, if you give people some lab environments where they can do that clicking and mm-hmm. find out what that automation actually does. But automation can be a danger for that.
Yeah, if you're going straight into automation and you've not got that experience of the various components and how they depend on each other, then when you're making changes, like you say, that are so easy to make because of automation, and they are at a scale far larger than what you would traditionally be dealing with in terms of you're maybe dealing with one or two servers at a time. Mm-hmm. And you'd have to go through multiple steps and, you know, there would be safety gates there. That's really not there with automation. So I think, yeah, there needs to be time spent understanding what you're automating and the different components that are involved in that. And I definitely think that, I mean, I've seen it before in teams of systems engineers where single engineers have known the specifics of a customer environment, or single engineers have been the expert on storage or on backup. And that is a major problem when that engineer is on holiday or is sick or is too busy because he's dealing with something, he or she is dealing with something else. And I think that if that translates into automation, then you're right, it is dangerous. It could cause pretty significant problems.
Yeah, this is also one that is pretty easy to keep track of by making sure people do get the chance to work with small environments, small steps, have someone hold their hand for them, mm-hmm. show them what way to go. But it's something you need to be more cautious about than you did have to do when the automation wasn't that big.
Mm-hmm. And also something that needs an environment where people can not only be comfortable asking for confirmation or double checking or saying that they're not sure, but almost a culture that is the thing to be done. That's a feature of the team. So checking, I think you speak at some point about having sort of four eyes on a change, etc. Being able to work with your team, understand each other's strengths and weaknesses you need to have that team ethos of speaking up.
Yeah, that's the 4I principle.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very known in other fields, which just says every change needs to be approved by two people, and everything we do, you need to brainstorm with each other, but also you need to make sure that someone knows what you are doing.
Yeah.
And that's also to protect you from, I'm not sure if that's an international saying. We always say, what if you get hit by a bus?
That is amazing.
I don't like that one. I always say, what if you win the lottery?
Yes, that's the more positive version.
But there's something that I see that a lot of people don't realize, and that is if you become sick, either mentally or physically, often you have you are becoming sick while you're still working. And you come to the point where you need to stop working because you're that sick, and you could be out of it for some time. But that means at the time leading up to that, you also haven't been working your best.
Yeah.
And you might find, if you have not prepared time to document and to make sure other people know what you are working on, then that's one of the first things you're going to let go because you do not have the energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if 2020 teaches us anything...
And we can count on nothing.
Yes, we can count on nothing. And, I really do hope that everyone is kind of thinking, right, documentation, communication, you know, making sure we're all on the same page is so important, because tomorrow is not guaranteed. That also sounds really negative, and I don't mean it to sound negative, but I think it's just having a realistic perspective on life that things do go wrong.
And if you've got everything documented and you've worked with someone together, then at least your work can continue.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that actually brings me to one of the things that I also have seen going wrong and I've experienced myself is the influence of your personal well-being on how you do your work. Okay. If you are stressed or if you're tired or you've got some personal stuff going on, I mean, we've all got our personal stuff, but that's the point where it's so much easier to make a mistake.
Yes.
And I did that myself once, and it was a really small one, so I'm not afraid to talk about it. It didn't happen with code, actually, but I was working for a customer, and I had a server, and I needed to make a connection from another server with a certain port, and I couldn't get it to go through. And so what I did is I turned off the Windows firewall temporarily to see if that was the problem. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I thought it would help to block all connections. And that was that moment that I pushed that button and you feel time slowing down. And your life flashes before you and you think, because my RDP session was closed. And I got kicked off the server. And the funny thing was that was a production server. Mm. So I thought, people are getting thrown out. And then I looked in the Hyper-V manager to get contact with it to open it up again. I thought it was still running. And apparently I was working in another server that I thought I was working. And that was a management server. So my one mistake fixed my other mistake.
Yep.
But after I opened that port again, I immediately shut everything down and I went home because I said, I'm too tired. It was the end of the day.
Yep.
But that's one really simple thing where the damage wasn't that big. But if you're doing that with code, it is important to think for yourself, am I alert?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do I know what I'm doing? If you get foggy, might be time to go outside for a bit.
Yeah, I think that's such an important thing that people probably don't think about enough, is having the self-awareness to check, you know, am I alert? Am I focused? Can I focus? Is there things on my to-do list, either in my personal life or my work life, that are distracting me so much that actually would be better for me to schedule some time to deal with them and then come back to this task? And also asking yourself things like, do you work better in the morning or do you work better at the evening? In the evening, I have a friend who's a software engineer for a large bank. And he knows that he works better in like afternoon, evening. Mm-hmm. And so like he's aware of that now. So he will sometimes plan his day around that, depending on what tasks he's got, which I think is a really self-aware and good approach to take. I mean, yeah. I know in myself when I am stressed, and that has definitely been the case over the last few weeks, because my memory goes, I can't remember anything. And that's a big thing for me, because my memory is absolutely spot on. When I was little, my mum used to refer to me as an elephant, because she would literally tell me everything that she had to do and I'd remember it all. But when I know when I go from that to basically not being able to remember what I did yesterday, that is a bad sign. And I need to take some time off, and I need to get outside, and I need to go and fix whatever's bothering me so that I can come back and be productive. Because it's not a good feeling either when you know you're not performing your best. Mm-hmm. And then you keep trying and you keep failing. It's not a productive way of working for anyone.
Yeah, and it's not always possible to say, well, I'll just get out of the situation, or I'll deal with it. Of course, sometimes it can be hard. And like I said, I went through a company going down. Mm-hmm. I worked a lot of hours that weekend.
Yeah.
And there was no question of stopping. And that wouldn't work, because my mind was too occupied with everything. So it was good to keep on going. But what I did a lot, we had a lot of talks with the team, and what I did a lot was tell people what they could still expect of me.
Mm.
And put some boundaries, like do not put me in a place where I need to talk to a lot of people at this point, because mm-hmm. I'm out of words and that takes a lot of energy. Let me just fix technical stuff and I'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And so you can work with each other on that. So it's not all black and white. You need to quit when it's over.
Yeah.
When you feel yourself going, but you need to think, well, what can I do to protect myself at this point? What can I do to have a little bit more peace of mind? Are there some projects that I can let go? Or is some work now more suitable for me than other work?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Before you get to that point, you should recognize it. Sometimes I'm bad at that.
But it's hard and you keep learning.
Yeah, I definitely got better over the years. But having that self-awareness and being able to identify potentially when you're reaching that point. Obviously, it's different when you're in a scenario where something's gone down and you are, you know, you have to fix it. That's just what you need to do. But I think that's a really great way of looking at it as well, is still communicating around boundaries and expectations and putting those in place so that you can do your best in that terrible situation.
Yeah. Yeah, so that, I think it's a really important one, the personal well-being, how you handle that. Mm-hmm. But there's one more reason I see so much for scripts going wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's my personal coined term. I thought of it myself, and it's YOLO scripting.
YOLO scripting, yeah.
YOLO scripting, and I asked it with my talk. I said, how many people here have ever run a script directly from the internet without reading it through? And almost all the hands went up, including my own. And then I asked who did it in production, then a few hands went down. The thing is with YOLO scripting, I also, when I do it, I also like to say, ooh, what does this button do? I'm not sure what it's going to do, but I'm going to click it. The thing is, it's so much fun to script that way and learn that way.
Mm.
But there's a time and a place. Because I love doing YOLO scripting. I love thinking, I'm not sure what this script's going to do, so I'm going to run it and see where it goes. But I always do that on a separate virtual machine or some secure environment.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised with how many people I see doing it in production. And I see people just running a script. And you can even ask them, they take it from the internet and you say, well, that's some nice code. What exactly does it do? I don't know. I didn't read it. Mm. It said it worked. So YOLO, push the button. The problem is it often goes right.
Yes.
So people are not very discouraged to do it. But if you do this with a script in production and it goes wrong, it can go wrong in so many ways.
Yeah. And you won't know how to even start to troubleshoot it. So is
because you have no idea what you did.
Yeah. So is this because everyone now basically shares their code on the likes of GitHub? And like you said, most of it works, or you'll see that it's from a particular person that you know is good at their job or writes good code. And therefore, I can see how that would be tempting to just sort of take those bits and pieces and join them together and run them and kind of hope for the best. But and I suppose the ability to share those code, etc., on GitHub, know who they're coming from, probably creates a level of comfort that's great for learning, sharing, you know, learning new things, etc., but not good for sort of increasing that comfortability around running code that's not yours and you don't know how it works in production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is a, I think it's already good if you do some research on who wrote the code.
Yeah.
And I'm actually a bit glad that Microsoft closed down TechNet, the TechNet gallery, because I have heard more than once people say, this is a good script because it's from TechNet, so it's from Microsoft.
Mm.
I'd say, no, it's not.
That's not a good enough reason.
But it makes sense that people think that.
Yeah.
So yeah. I'm actually a bit glad that they closed it down and said, well, find each other on GitHub. And there are some awesome scripts out there who do really good stuff. And if you read it through a bit and you can use it like that, as long as you don't do some research, mm-hmm. you will probably will be fine.
Yeah.
And if you protect yourself while you're doing it, there's a time and a place for YOLO scripting.
Yes. There is a time and a place for YOLO type decisions in all possibility. So it's only natural that should translate to scripting as well.
I used to, that's not with coding, but I used to troubleshoot servers and stuff like that. And one of my favorite things to say is, this is already broken, right?
What could go wrong?
I'm going to click this button. I'm not sure what it's going to do, but it's broken already. Of course, you need to be, I mean, it's what makes the work fun, but you need to be really careful with that. How are you going to make that fun safe for your environment?
Yeah.
It could be doing it somewhere else. It could be using some testing beforehand, stuff like that. There are some technical options out there to make this safe.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with YOLO is that you're not doing that.
Yeah.
Because that's not YOLO.
Yeah, YOLO's not safe.
No, that makes it boring. But it is good to think about... I do appreciate YOLO scripting because you can learn a lot from it and it's so much fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to teach courses where we had computers that we would reinstall after every course. And I always would say to my students, this is the time to not be afraid to wreck your environment.
Mm.
Because I don't care if you do. I encourage you to do it. And the one who does it first gets bonus points. And it's a great way of learning. But I see it a little too often in production.
Mm, yeah. Okay. So I think we've covered, would you say that's three main things that you see going wrong? So YOLO scripting, lack of maybe self-awareness and sort of well-being and whether you are in the right frame of mind to be scripting. And then what was the first one we spoke about?
Proving yourself,
yes. The need to prove yourself and being afraid or uncomfortable with confirming and double checking and asking questions. So those are the sort of three things that you see.
Yeah, I think you can add communication as a whole, but I think that's a bit too easy.
Absolutely. It's so true though. Like really, really the problem in all of these areas and in so many areas that I've spoken about on the podcast is communication. But people want to know what specifically they need to fix when it comes to communication. So how do you then go about protecting your team from those potential pitfalls as a team.
Yeah, so how do you move on so you don't fall in all those traps? So basically, how do you create that harnesses and that ropes when you're riding code and working as a team?
Yeah.
And there's something important, like what you said, is the question is, how do you protect your team? And I think that's the most important question, in that it's not about what your company is doing or what technology you're using or about your who you are as an individual. This is about you as a team and how you protect yourself from these mistakes, because you deserve to do that as a team. Especially when something goes wrong, you need to tackle it together. How can we protect each other in the long run from this happening again?
Yeah.
And the first thing, and I think one of the most hard ones, is to don't play the blame game.
Yeah.
And I know you see that a lot, where it's just like, well, can I blame the other guy?
Mm-hmm.
It's not my problem anymore. But even here, if someone makes a mistake, your first instinct might be to get angry about it. And I felt it myself. I was disappointed. I was angry. And it was actually a hard feeling, because you're trying to build something, but you have these emotions going on and you need to acknowledge that they exist, and that's all right, but you can't get stuck in it. And you can't blame people on the long run. Well, you have done that before. Stuff like that. You really need to let that go, because you are in this together.
Mm-hmm.
And being in this together means that your environments, people need to trust each other and they need to count on each other and be able to count on each other. So you do not start blaming each other for things that happened, but it also means that you make commitments to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, if you make a commitment where you say, we will always have two people looking at a change, then you should keep that, and you should keep each other accountable for that. And if you make these commitments, and really I prefer in writing even, especially when you're starting this process of creating that environment of trust.
Creating like a team charter even, you know.
Yeah.
What's our team charter? What's our mission? What's our values? What do we expect from each other? And then flowing that down into maybe, you know, more formal change processes, etc.
I've gone as far as hang them up.
Mm-hmm.
The 10 commitments.
I like it.
And they were a bit. There were some funny stuff on there to keep it lighthearted. It wasn't all that serious, but there were some commitments that we made with each other. Like, this is how we're going to protect ourselves.
Yeah.
And if someone doesn't keep themselves to that commitment, at that point, you can ask someone, what happened here?
Mm-hmm.
And if you ask someone what happened here, that's not a question with blame. It's a question that's saying, what happened, and how can we make sure this doesn't happen in the future?
Yeah, because I suppose in these scenarios, it is easy to place blame potentially at one individual's feet, because so often it comes from an individual's decision and a specific task, a specific click. But really, what you need to understand is what led them to that decision, and why was there not, you know, why did they get to the point of being able to do that? Is it actually a team failing? Was it the end, you know, what do we need to improve? Because if you don't think about it like that, then you could, you know, the next week someone else could do the same and you're blaming them, but nothing's getting fixed. And all the while, as a team, you're not looking great, you're not feeling great. It's not a fun environment, right?
Yeah, and one thing that I really felt in the past, when mistakes happened, and someone made that mistake, that means that the consequence of that mistake bear on one person.
Mm.
And that should just never happen. You should always be in it together. If you had looked at it with two people, this would already be a team commitment, where you would say, we're both responsible for that. And I think that's so important as well, that you make yourself so vulnerable when you just working on your own, working this kind of stuff, and it can break you if you bring something completely down. No one should experience that.
Yeah.
And it's the responsibility of the team to protect yourself from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that brings me to another thing which I think is so important in an environment of trust. I think we should have a ban on the line, "You should know that."
Mm.
And I've heard it from multiple people while I was working in IT environment, the line, "You should know that."
Mm.
It doesn't add anything.
No.
It doesn't help anything because someone is putting themselves out there and making themselves vulnerable by saying, "I'm not sure about what I'm doing," or mm-hmm. "I don't know."
And also, and they're coming to you as an expert, right? So not only is that person taking the chance, making themselves vulnerable, coming to you and saying, "I don't know how to do this," they know that you are an expert who likely does know how to do that, and they're asking for your help. Anyone who says anything like, "You should know that," or make someone feel bad for asking a question, is because deep down they are insecure and deep down they couldn't ask a question. They couldn't do that. So they need to put that person down to make themselves feel better. And that is the world's wide language of people who are bullies or any type of like that kind of behavior, is usually because inside they've got an insecurity that is being triggered by that behavior. That's just my two cents.
Yeah, it's often really an insecurity putting someone else down so you feel more up yourself. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even sure if people are that conscious that they are doing it like that.
And
I've also seen this in with people who really don't realize that they're bringing the other person down, because they really have forgotten that there was one point where they didn't know it themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
Where this is not something logical. This is something that you learned.
Mm-hmm.
And if you say something like, "You should know that," well, that other person is never going to ask anything about anything, probably.
Yeah.
To you. And now they're working on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And that really, in an environment of trust, people should be able to ask questions both way around. And it really should be encouraged. And of course, there's a gray area here. If someone really isn't qualified to a job, for a job, then of course, well, I still think there's no point in saying, "You should know that." I think you should take it up with a higher level, saying someone's not qualified. But yeah, with the... You change your attitude if you're always thinking, "Well, you should know that," or, I mean, and there's nothing wrong with saying you should look that up.
Yeah.
But then you need to get back to someone saying, "Did it help?"
Yeah.
Or assume that people already have looked it up.
But yeah.
That is an assumption.
Yeah, you can always say, "Why don't you go and look up this?" And you can give them a bit of direction on what to search for, the specific topic, etc., and then say, "Come back to me if you still have questions." That, there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually probably a really great way of teaching someone how to learn themselves. But yeah, okay, I'm with you. We're banning "You should know that."
Yeah. Awful sentence, doesn't help with anything. So we have don't play the blame game.
Yeah.
Create an environment of trust and make commitments to each other.
Yes. Setting commitments and expectations of each other, I think, is really important. Also being clear about what others can expect from you and what they can't expect from you, I think, is important as well.
Yeah, and if you're really open about that, for example, someone can say, "Today I just want to work on a project, so I'm not open for questions for just one day." That's fine. If that's what you need at that point, as long as you don't have it every day.
Yeah.
And there's some open communication about that.
Yeah, you're letting people know that that's where you're at for today. It's just a day and then you'll be back. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. It can happen, but you do need to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And something that they do in an agile workflow, for example, is have meetings that look back on the work process for the previous period, which can be just 2 weeks, but then you have a small meeting where you just look back on what you did, how the work process went, what went well, and what things you think could have gone better.
Mm-hmm. And it's nice that it's a short period like that, because when you try to do, and I know this from experience, when you try to do lessons learned on like a traditional type project, well, first of all, how many times does anybody actually complete a lesson learned or get the engagement from people that you need for the lesson learned, or even be able to get the time from them because they're onto something else? Whereas if you can do that periodic review, if it's every 2 weeks, I just think that's such a better way of doing it.
Yeah, they call it the retrospective, and there's a whole lot more to it, and I'm not an expert on that, so look it up if you find it interesting. But I do, since I have worked with that even in other teams, I do find myself looking back on a short period thinking, okay, what went well and what could have gone better? It helps you communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. So that moves us a bit to what options you have to help yourself with some fake goals, like create an environment of trust.
I know. It's such an easy thing to say, you know, create an environment of trust and safety. It is more difficult to do. And that's definitely, and I think as well, that's important to recognize. So a lot of people can go about this and say, we're going to create an environment of trust and safety, and everyone should just feel super comfortable to ask questions. Go. And I think it's really important to understand how difficult that is, how different individuals in the team will be feeling about that. They'll be coming at it from different perspectives. It's going to take a while. And I think you should be really authentic and honest about that process with your team. I think if you just throw out these buzzwords, people just go, yeah, whatever. I think if you sit down and have, you know, you lead by example and have an honest conversation about that and admit that it will take time to build, then you probably have a better starting chance at actually creating that environment of trust and safety.
Yeah, and realize it takes time to, I mean, you're chasing a culture, so take some time. And that's where the retrospectives can actually help. So looking back at the previous period, maybe you have some commitments with each other that are not working. Mm. And then you can keep saying to each other, you're not keeping your commitment. Or you can think, well, how can we make sure we do keep the commitment? Is it a good commitment? Do we need to change it a bit?
Yeah. Is this actually necessary? Is there someone else that can do it better?
Yeah, or do we want to do it another way around? Mm. Do we want to change our team dynamic a bit where it is more fitting to our work environment?
And I suppose having those conversations initially might feel quite personal. People might quite, you know, when you say like you've made a commitment and you're not keeping it. And I think that those conversations will be very uncomfortable to begin with. And I think stating that is probably helpful. So saying, this is going to be uncomfortable because once we make commitments to each other, we're also going to ask each other to hold each other to those commitments. And that means that we're going to need to come and say sometimes, you know, I'm not getting this from you. But I think it's like ripping the band-aid off. The quicker you do it and the more that you have those uncomfortable conversations, they soon become more comfortable and productive and less scary.
Yeah. And you need to allow yourself time to really get comfortable with you. And it does mean as a team, you need to have some sort of connection and keep track of each other. And this all is a lot harder with everyone working from home, especially if you're not used to it.
Yes.
You can do this all while working from home, but it does take some adjustments. And yeah, let's face it, we're not just working from home. We're working from home in a
pandemic.
Thank you. And that's really different Yeah. That's something we do need to realize. You're on a higher level of stress naturally.
Yeah, I'm sure I've seen a tweet that said, we're not working from home, we're living at work, which is an interesting take on it. I think I've said this before, it's been natural for me to work more because specifically in the beginning of lockdown, things are easing up here now and we can do a bit more. But at the beginning, work was the only thing I had to do in my house. So, you know, I was like, well, let's just work all the time, which was great for the first few weeks, but quickly reached burnout, which is never good. So I suppose now more than ever, communication is more important.
And this can be simple things. Well, not for now, but in a regular environment. I know when I was still working at offices, I was always at the office, and I always found it hard to connect to people who were working at home. And I expressed that. I said, it might be something that's just me, but it's bothering me at this point. And we made some commitments. We're saying, well, one day or 2 days a week, everyone is at the office. Mm-hmm. And on other days, people can work from home. So we made some compromises that way and searched for if that worked to work together better. Mm-hmm. It's really simple things like that can really make it very concrete. Yeah, well, not in these times, but regularly.
Yeah. Yeah. How, is there any more points that you want to cover on this? Because I want to make sure that we do cover all your points. Because then I was going to ask you a little bit about how lockdown has changed your life.
I do want to mention some technical things that are available to make it easier.
Yeah, let's do that.
Some tooling that is available, a major tool if you're working with code, is Git. Mm. And Git is one of the things where a lot of people assume everyone knows how it works. Well, Git is extremely hard to learn.
So can you give me a bit of a 101 on what Git is? So from like a non-technical perspective, I vaguely understand what it is. And I even now have an account because I've been helping out on the Cloud Lunch and Learn sessions, and they have a GitHub repository. So I have an account now, but that's all I have. Could you maybe give a 101 on what Git is? I think that would be useful.
Well, Git is a technology that you can use. Well, it is meant for code. You can use it for any file that you wish. You shouldn't, because it's really not that good for large files. So it's meant to work with code files. And it gives you an environment where you have two things that can really help with your coding experience. One of those is version control. Mm-hmm. So if you write a script and you change something, then you commit that again to your environment, then the old script is still saved. You can still see where you came from. And a lot of people know when you write scripts, you will start working on the script, and then it's a script V2, V3, V3, script final, script final now really. And it can become really messy, and everyone has done this. So Git takes that away for you. Okay. So the version control, you can always see the complete history of the scripts, which is really handy if it's working in a production environment, because you have an auditing trail of who has changed the script at one point. And the second thing it does is it helps you work together on scriptings. And there is some technology out there that two people can make changes to the same files. And there's this whole procedure for that with branches and stuff. I won't go too deeply into that, but you can start working on projects on the same time, and it can also give you a place where you can say, I want to say this script is ready, but I want someone to review it for me.
Okay.
And it gives an environment for that where you can ask questions and give comments on the code.
Okay.
And Git is a technology that we assume people know. This is one of the famous you should know that I have found. And I found Git very hard to get into because there's so much going on that mostly I'd given up by the end of reading because I thought, well, this is too complicated for me. Mm. I actually wrote some blog posts really focused on using Git as a beginner with PowerShell, and it's really practical, and I have used that guide so often. There are so many people who say, now I finally get it because I just start using it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot more going on than just this, but this can just so really help with working together on your scripts. Also, so see who has worked on the scripts, who is doing what. You can track the issues with the script, so you can really structure around the scripting, which makes it a more serious part of your environment.
Okay, nice. So I suppose, though, as a team, like you say, and I think this is such a common thing with tools that are meant to solve problems, people just say, okay, we're going to start using Git now, or okay, we're going to start using like Teams. Even things like that, they just throw them in and they're like, this will make team communication awesome, just magically. And for instance, I have been added to so many teams over the past like couple of months, but I'm kind of like, okay, I can absolutely see how this is amazing and is going to make collaboration better, but can we please talk about how we're going to use the team? So what communication is it for? What communication is it not for? What files are we storing? What are we not storing? Like, what is the process and how do we use the tool? So I suppose with Git, it must be the same, right? It's got all these great functions that you can use to work better together as a team, but you all need to know, there's a difference between knowing Git and knowing how your team uses Git.
Yeah, because there's also different tooling there and there's different standards. So it's really good to have some conversations on that. Yeah, and the best environment, in my opinion, is when you're learning it together.
Mm.
When you start using it together. And I remember I did that with Azure DevOps, which has a Git provider. It can do Git for one, but it has a lot of different tooling out there. And we started using it for Git, and we already knew how to work Git. And that was where we started playing around with pipelines.
Mm.
And with a pipeline, you can implement automated testing, which is such a great tool to have to protect yourself. Basically, automated testing is your rope.
Yes.
This can save you from falling down. The problem with automated testing is it takes a lot of time.
Okay.
And that's time that you didn't account for when you thought about the change. And it has to be in your mindset to do it, because it doesn't seem productive. It doesn't seem to have a return on investment, which of course it does.
Mm-hmm.
But you need to explain that to the right people.
Yes.
And make sure you get the time for it. And that can really be your rope. And you can use Azure DevOps, but also in GitHub, you now have GitHub Actions, where you can say, I can automatically test all my code.
Mm-hmm.
See if it does what I expect it to be doing, and if it's not doing that it won't be pushed to production.
Okay.
So you can, it's literally a rope. It can really help you not falling down that mountain.
Yeah, this is definitely all the safety equipment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that can be a really nice tool as well. I mentioned Azure DevOps for that. Azure DevOps also has some planning tools, which mm-hmm. can really help if you're making commitments with each other. The Azure DevOps boards, they are really nice if you want to plan all the tasks that your team needs to do and make room for education or for writing those tests.
Yeah, make sure there's an action in there for that specifically.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, with automated testing, you often have the issue, what is the return on investment? How do you make that visible for people? And that's one other very important tool, and that is mandate. You need to be allowed to invest time for this, and you need to have someone in your company that has a say in your team that has your back.
Mm. Yeah,
that will support you as a team. Yeah. And that can be tricky. And I always say the best way to get that mandate is to have your company go down.
Yeah.
Because then they understand why you're going to do that. It's not, well, it's very effective, but not the most fun way to do it.
No, not the most positive experience.
So at that point, you might want to think about, how can I make this visible? Mm-hmm. How can I make visible why there's a profit in us working this way? And you can show you can get more work done, mm-hmm. for example. But I think you actually have some graphs on the Microsoft site somewhere on what a mistake costs depending on in what stage of the development it is.
Okay, that's nice. So yeah, like if you catch a mistake earlier, it's not going to cost as much. You're going to be able to fix it sooner. If you catch a mistake in production,
it's going to cost a lot of money.
It's going to cost a lot of money. And you know, you can show, you might not want to show your company going down as an example. You can definitely point to, like we were talking earlier, news examples of companies suffering the same. And I think as well, what I've come to learn is that people love reporting and they love visuals, right? They love it. So mm-hmm. if you show a graph or you can show like a visual representation of that pipeline and that process, and then show like how many changes you can make that went through the automated testing period and they were all okay, it means that you could get on to other work. Whereas, you know, if an issue had gone wrong in production that you hadn't caught, then you might be delayed for weeks. So it allows more consistency. And when you can show those kind of things in statistics and graphs, etc., people love it.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially
So these are, if you think about the actions and the tooling, you can use Git, you can use Azure DevOps, mm-hmm. Try to get that mandate so you know what you're doing, really invest in that automatic testing, mm-hmm. invest in that 4i principle, because that's also one that's really concrete.
Yeah.
We will not do a change unless at least two people have seen it. And when you implement that, make sure that the reviewer tells the one who asks for the review, or the other way around, what they expect from each other.
Okay.
Because a review can be, well, looks good.
Yeah.
Fine. Or you can have a thorough review where everything is actually checked, because can you make an assumption that your colleague has actually tested every line? That can be possible, that you can make that assumption, but you should talk to each other. Have you tested everything? Then I'm not going to do that because I trust you. Or if you're not sure about it, I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah, but you should set up front an agreement of what a review constitutes. And you might have different levels of reviews, right? You might have like a bronze, silver, gold level of review, and depending on what change it is, you might, you know, if you've got those already defined as a team, you might say, this requires this kind of review, what do you think? Yep, agreed. And you go off and you do it.
Yeah. And then it's also easier to make time for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah, because you would need to schedule that in, so you need to know what's expected of you, how much effort that's going to take.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, pretty much. And the whole motto is, don't code without ropes.
Yes.
And there's a time and a place for YOLO scripting.
Yeah. Do not, what is it called? Solo climb? Free solo climb?
Yeah, free solo. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, everyone go and watch that movie. Basically do the opposite of that when you're scripting. And get really clear on the time and the place for YOLO scripting. And also, I would say that a massive theme throughout all of this really is self-awareness.
Yeah.
Self-awareness and communicating expectations and boundaries with your team.
Yeah, and be honest about it. Mm-hmm. Not too honest, but you know what I mean? Be honest with what people can expect of you, what you expect of people, and think of yourself if it's fair what you're expecting of people, what you want them to expect of you.
Yeah. Is it reasonable?
You need to come together in that. Yeah.
And no more saying you should know that.
Absolutely.
Please replace it. If you're not conscious of it, please replace it with, go and look up this. Then come back to me. Circle back and ask.
create a little jar for that, where if you say it, you have to put money in it.
Yes, that's a brilliant idea. That is a brilliant idea. Well, that has been awesome. And I, you know, if in fact, I will link in the notes to this episode the recording of your Ignite talk.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's so impressive that you've managed to do a 20-minute talk on that. And then also we've managed to speak for around about an hour on that topic, I think.
It is actually, people warned me beforehand saying 20-minute talks are far harder than 45-minute talks. And I didn't believe them until I had to do it. It was so hard to do it in 20 minutes.
I think I would struggle to do anything talking in 20 minutes. People ask me, you know, how long do you plan your podcast to be? And I'm like, well, I started off around 45 minutes to an hour, and they all tend to go over an hour. And some people have said they're maybe a little bit too long, but I was like, but I'm doing this for me, really.
And we're not done yet. Simple.
I know. And I also think as well, I tend to listen to my podcast when I go on a walk. I go on quite a long walk.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the podcast that I have in my head. So that just kind of tends to be what's happening. But time flies when you're talking about this kind of thing, because it's so interesting. So interesting and so relevant as well. So thank you so much for coming on and sharing that with me. I loved it.
Yeah, it was great.
How are you coping in lockdown? We'll just have a little bit of a lockdown chat before we log off.
Well, I need to start with the Netherlands. We haven't had a very heavy lockdown.
Okay.
We have had what they call an intelligent lockdown.
Nice.
And basically the schools were closed and the restaurants and the bars were closed.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was told to work from home if they could. But we could still go outside. Shops were still open with a maximum amount of people in there.
Okay.
And we were told we could go outside as long as we kept distance from each mm-hmm. other.
Yeah.
So it really helped me that we were just able to be outside.
Yeah, that's nice.
And I think I walked more in that first month than the month before that.
Yeah.
Because it was a way to get away from it. As long as you kept your distance, then it would be fine. So, and now most of the lockdown has been cleared. We are still working from home.
Yeah.
And I get to spend a lot of time with my dog, which I love.
Nice. That's lovely.
So I think I'm doing pretty well. I have a pretty good environment around here, so I can't complain.
That's nice. Did you used to do a lot of traveling prior
yeah,
to
that? I never worked from home. I really disliked working from home.
Really?
I always went to the office, and mm-hmm. as a consultant you need to go to the companies. It's part of the job. And that's fine. And like I said, I never worked home. I always liked to go to the office.
Yeah.
And it did take some adjusting in the beginning. I made really conscious decisions to make sure I divided work life with personal life. And especially if you don't have all the tools yet and you can't buy anything because it's all sold out. And
yes. that has been such the case for the last few months.
Yeah,
everyone's gone crazy on upgrading their home offices.
Yeah, I still haven't been able to find a camera at the old price. They're mm-hmm. still like twice as expensive as before the crisis. So I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, no, definitely just wait until they come back down.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, you have to make it work. But like I said, I don't think I am in a position to complain too much. I think I have a good environment to work from home. So
yeah. And I think as well, you know, going back to kind of something that we touched on at the beginning around first world problems and perspective, something I have been extremely thankful for is the fact that I still have a job. The fact that I still have a job, I still have been on full pay, and actually also having that job has meant I've had something to do with my time when we were in full lockdown. And I am extremely thankful for that, because I know quite a few people who that's not been the case for. And that's not great to hear at all. So I'm extremely thankful and appreciative of the fact that I do still have a job.
Absolutely. And even the people who do still have their job, but they had to stay at home because their job was closed.
Mm.
And you have to do nothing for a month and a half.
I know. Because people always think that they would love to just not have a job and do nothing, but doing nothing gets old quick.
Yeah, absolutely.
I remember I had I've worked since I was 14, so probably worked before I was it was legal for me to work. But I've worked since I was 14, and I remember being out of work for a few weeks just after I'd finished university. And I mean, first week, watched all the daytime TV, was loving it. And then I was like, I hate this. Give me a job. I'll do anything. it's not a good feeling. Definitely thankful for that. I'm just hoping that things start to return to normal. I really don't know when we're going to see normal again, to be honest. I'm going to visit my friend in Edinburgh so this will be the first time that I've left Dundee since March, and the first time that I will have seen my friends that are outside of Dundee. And I'm going to visit this weekend. I'm going to stay the night. I'm going to get to see my godson and his little sister, and I am so excited. I can't wait. They've also got a new puppy. So really, it's going to be like the best weekend ever.
Yeah.
Feeling like a new person at the end of it.
Yeah, we get to appreciate all the things that
we thought
were very useful.
Definitely.
I hope we will keep track of some of that working from home, especially since it's so much better for the environment.
Yeah.
Not spend your time in a car.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll see where it goes.
We'll have a new generation of people walking as well, I think.
Yeah, well, in the Netherlands, we all travel by bike anyway.
Yes, that's true. I bought myself a bike. You can actually see it in this video. I've still only been on it a couple of times. Me and my little brother have been taking them places. He's got a big van, so we just throw the bikes in the van and take it to some woods and stuff that are nearby, which has been really fun. So hoping to do more of that, and like you say, I do hope that people will take stock of what's really important. I think that's what's come out of this for me. Focus on the simple things in life, like friends and family and walking. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Barbara. That has been an awesome chat. This may be one of my longest podcasts. So we'll see.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we'll see when we put that out. That's going to be fun. but thank you so much for joining me. And thanks for sharing all your experiences as well and your knowledge. I think, you know, whether you are in a team of devs that are scripting or just in a team that are trying to work together in IT, I think you can take so much away from this episode and the knowledge that you've shared. So thank you so much.
Yeah, this was great. Thank you for having me.
No worries. See you later.
All right.
Hey guys, if you made it to the end of this episode, let me know on Twitter, because I think it was potentially my longest episode, but such a good one. I really do enjoy recording these episodes for the podcast. See you again next Friday.